This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Stephen King's TV miniseries, The Stand, begins Sunday night. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're featuring a 1992 interview with King. Some of Stephen King's best-known books have been made into films, including Misery, Carrie, The Shining, The Dead Zone, Cujo, and Pet Sematary. I spoke to King after the publication of his novel, Gerald's Game. As the book opens, a married couple is in their forest cabin. They're ready to play their S&M sex game. She's on the bed. Her wrists are cuffed to the bedpost. He is undressing. She realizes she's tired of this game. It seems stupid, ridiculous, and corny. But she can't get her husband to stop, and that makes her furious. As he forces himself on her, she kicks him where it hurts most. He collapses, suffers a heart attack, and dies. Then she is alone, cuffed to the bed, in the middle of the woods. Now the horror really begins. I asked Stephen King what made him think about how corny sex games can be.
Actually, Gerald's Game started with the concept of the woman being chained to the bed. I'd written a book before where a woman and a small child were stuck in a car that was sort of surrounded, if you will, by a rabid St. Bernard. That book was called Cujo. And essentially, what a lot of that book was two people in a very small room, although it did have a shifting perspective so that it went to other characters. And I thought originally, this was the takeoff point for the book, wouldn't it be interesting to see what would happen if you had one character in a room? The question then became, what caused this woman to be in this room by herself? And the answer that I came up with was bondage. She's handcuffed to a bed. And that forced me to sort of consider what causes people to do this sort of thing. And so once I'd set up the situation, I knew what it was going to be. I went in and read a little bit about it and thought a little bit about it. And the whole thing struck me as a little bit Victorian. There was something very snidely whiplash about the whole thing, and I tried to get that into the book.
Well, you do in a very funny way. I mean, the husband says to his wife as she's handcuffed to the bedpost, he says, "I'll teach you me proud beauty."
Yes, exactly.
Pronouncing beauty the way the landlord in a bad Victorian melodrama might.
You can almost see him waxing his mustaches, can't you?
Right, right, right. So you got the corniness and the danger of this kind of S&M sex play. In an interview a few years ago, you once said that one of the major reasons that you've been left alone is that your books are fairly asexual. Is this a change for you?
Well, it is and it isn't. You know, Peter Straub, with whom I collaborated on a book once called The Talisman, once joked and said, "Stevie hasn't discovered sex yet." But actually, I never saw any particular reason to go into sex unless it formed an integral part of the plot. It never had before, and here it does. You know, it's a little bit like that story that you sometimes hear about the little kid. Everybody assumes that he's mute. He doesn't say anything until he's 4 years old, and then one day in perfectly articulated English, he says to his mother, "Mother, may I have a glass of water?" And she says, "You talk. Why didn't you ever say anything before?" And he says, "All my needs were met. I never had to. This is, you know, the first time that it came up." So for me, this was the first time that sex came up in the course of, you know, as it being a main element in terms of driving the plot. And it gave me a chance to take a look at a wide range of not only sexual material, but I don't know what you call it, stuff that ranged from the pornographic to the merely titillating. And a lot of what I saw through the considering eye of somebody who was planning to write about this, who used this as a building block, was a little disturbing. It seemed to me that there was a lot of stuff about men wanting to be empowered, to be in control in a way that struck me at least as essentially unhealthy, which in turn kicked off a whole sort of subplot, a center of the book that has to do with child molestation and maybe where some of these things come from.
Mm-hmm. This is hardly, though, the first time you've tried writing about sex. You once tried to write a porn novel while you were still in college. But you
yeah, I did.
Do it.
I did actually try to write a porn novel when I was in college. But you have to realize that I was stony broke. I was living in a place called the University Cabins, living on fried Cheerios and peanut butter and beer. And I'd read in a writer's magazine that there were a couple of publishing companies. I think one of them was Olympia Books. That would pay $600 to $800 cash on acceptance for porno novels that ran from, I think, 25,000 to 40,000 words. I read a couple of things from the market and thought, I can do that in $600 isn't much, but I can do it in 10 days, and that's a living wage, and at least it will buy some hamburger to go with the fried Cheerios. And so I tried, but I just couldn't make it happen. I mean, I reached a point where I just tipped over, and what I was writing at that moment was a scene where two twin sisters are having lesbian sex in a birdbath, and I got to that point, and I just said, hey, no, I'm sorry, I can't do this.
Now, what was it about that scene that you couldn't take any further?
It wasn't the fantasy element. I'm not sure I can answer your question. I'm very comfortable with fantasy, as people who've read my books for years know, but I just couldn't believe it anymore myself. I think that one of the integral things about fantasy that makes it palatable to readers is that if the writer actually believes it himself, at least while he's writing it, and at this point I just collapsed into, I can remember very clearly sitting in front of the typewriter, which was on the old kitchen table, and just laughing until tears rolled out of my eyes and just throwing the whole thing in the wastebasket. It wasn't happening for me.
Let's get Stephen King to the kind of gore and terror and suspense that you create. There's a scene in Gerald's Game, your new novel, that I'd like you to read from. And this is a scene in which the wife is still handcuffed to the bedpost. Her husband is laying dead on the floor, and a stray vicious dog from the area has walked into the house and has started dining on the woman's dead husband. Would you read it for us?
I sure will. Gerald's widow's peak was in disarray, probably as a result of the dog's licking the blood out of it. But his glasses were still firmly in place. She could see his eyes, half open and glazed, glaring up from their puffy sockets at the fading sun ripples on the ceiling. His face was still a mask of ugly red and purple blotches, as if even death had not been able to assuage his anger at her sudden capricious. Had he seen it as capricious? Of course he had. Change of mind. Let go of him, she told the dog, but her voice was now meek and sad and strengthless. The dog barely twitched its ears at the sound of it and didn't pause at all. It merely went on pulling the thing with the disarrayed widow's peak and the blotchy complexion. This thing no longer looked like Disco Gerald, not a bit. Now it was only dead Gerald, sliding across the bedroom floor with a dog's teeth buried in its flabby biceps. A frayed flap of skin hung over the dog's snout. Jessie tried to tell herself it looked like wallpaper, but wallpaper did not, at least as far as she knew, come with moles and a vaccination scar. Now she could see Gerald's pink, fleshy belly, marked only by the small caliber bullet hole that was his navel. His penis flopped and dangled in its nest of black pubic hair. His buttocks whispered along the hardwood boards with ghastly, frictionless ease. Abruptly, the suffocating atmosphere of her terror was pierced by a shaft of anger so bright it was like a stroke of heat lightning inside her head. She did more than accept this new emotion. She welcomed it. Rage might not help her get out of this nightmarish situation, but she sensed it would serve as an antidote to her growing sense of shocked unreality. You bastard, she said in a low, trembling voice. You cowardly, slinking bastard.
That's Stephen King reading from his new novel, Gerald's Game. Do you think of yourself as having taken the horror novel to a kind of more physically explicit place than it had ever been before?
Yeah, I think that to some degree I did do that. I think probably I've been surpassed in that area by some of the people who've come after me. I'm thinking mostly of Clive Barker,
yeah.
Yeah. But you realize that when I started reading and experiencing horror, some of it that I was reading and experiencing came from a very graphic wellspring. And I'm thinking about the horror comics of the 1950s, things like Tales from the Crypt and the mm-hmm. Vault of Horror that can now be seen on home box office. And at the same time, I was discovering horror movies. I usually went by myself in the afternoon to the Highway Theater in Stratford, Connecticut, which is still there, incidentally, and saw things like I Was a Teenage Werewolf with Michael Landon, or I Was a Teenage Frankenstein, or whatever it happened to be. And it was there that I started to see that it might be possible to combine some of the classic elements with some of the things that I was seeing in the schlock press and the schlock movies.
When you would see movies like this, did they scare you or just amuse you?
No, they scared me. You have to remember that we're talking 10 or 11 years old, and even with a picture like Teenage Monster, where the flying saucer appeared to be a cool cigarette filter tip with a sparkler stuck in it, that it looked real to me because I was at a young and very credulous age. And one of the other things that I sensed is, as time went past and I got a little more discriminating in my ability to detect special effects, if not necessarily my sense of taste, was that when I wrote it, you never saw the zipper going up the monster's back, that when the imagination was in charge of special effects, they were always perfect. As perfect as the book was, anyway.
Mm-hmm. What did you like about being scared when you were young?
I liked the total surrender of emotional control. It was very important to me, and I would almost be willing to say sort of a lifesaver. I'd been raised in a family where emotional control was a really important thing. You weren't supposed to show you were afraid. You weren't supposed to show that you were in pain or frightened or sad. Happiness was permissible as long as it didn't go too far, because then one might be considered to be almost insane if one got too happy. So that emotional control was, you know, sort of a requirement. And all the movies, my brother, David, was crazy about Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin. That was his emotional release. It's all a form of emotional seduction. And for me, the terror was what really appealed to something that I think is probably just inside people, that there isn't any logical way to explain it. But I loved it, and I loved giving up that control.
Now, what about when you passed real terror? I mean, for instance, if you would pass a car accident, would you look or turn the other way?
I can't remember that a lot of that ever happened in my life. What I can remember is making a very clear and conscious differentiation between make-believe horror, like I Was a Teenage Werewolf, and something real that happened. When I was a kid, at around the same time that Michael Landon was playing that werewolf, the make-believe werewolf, there was a kid named Charlie Starkweather who took his girlfriend, Carol Ann Fugate, and the two of them went on a killing spree across the Midwest. They killed, I don't know, 10 or 11 people in Nebraska and then over in Wyoming where they were captured. And he was put to death in the electric chair. And I kept a scrapbook about these people. You know, I would cut out the items and paste them in this scrapbook that I had. And my mother was very disturbed about it. This was in the mid-50s, and it was a time when child psychology was not exactly in vogue. But I think that if it had been, she probably would have sent me to one. I think that I can remember her saying, why are you interested in these people, Stephen? What is it? And what I was not able to explain at 10 or 11 years old was, I want to know these people if I ever run into them. Not because they attract me, but because they scare the hell out of me. I want to know what the real beast in the real world looks like so I can steer clear of him or her or them.
We're listening to a 1992 interview with Stephen King. His miniseries, The Stand, begins Sunday night on ABC. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Horror writer Stephen King is my guest. To write the kind of fiction that you do, you really have to think about how people respond when they're terrified and how they deal with pain. How they deal with pain and with fear and terror. Do you handle pain well, and has that ability ever really been tested?
You know, I don't think anybody knows how they deal with pain. Everybody's pain is so individual. And so we have no basis for comparison. I think that pain is really the ocean that's between us. You know, I think it was John Donne said, no man is an island. But in fact, I'm sorry, John, but we are. And when you're dying of cancer, you do it alone. And when you have migraine headaches, which is something that I'm prone to, you do that alone. But if I have a really terrible headache, what I call one of my headbusters, I wonder how that would stack up against someone else's pain. But I don't know, because there's no way to tell. There's no valid basis for comparison because we don't feel each other's pain. The interesting thing to me, more interesting than pain in my life or the comparative levels of that sort of thing, is that experiences about pain and experiences of extreme terror, I think, make it possible to see the world that we live in, the mundane, everyday world, in much greater detail. Small things, unimportant things, stand forth in a way that they don't. My experience of being under tremendous stress, physical stress or emotional or mental stress, is that things that otherwise just sort of fall outside what we think of as the tunnel of perception, our tunnel vision, kind of spring forward again, and I see them all over again. For me and Gerald's game, some of the most interesting passages, there's one section where this woman has to get a glass of water off a shelf, and in another one, she realizes that because she is handcuffed to the bed, she can't quite get the glass to her lips, and what she does then is, for me, was one of the most interesting and challenging parts of writing the book, not because it's an adventure, but because it uses very prosaic, everyday things to make suspense. And so it makes us look at them again and say, oh, what is that? And that's the experience, it seems to me, of brand new perception of childhood, that sort of reaction of, oh, look at that. And maybe the adult doesn't see that thing at all.
What have been your greatest moments of terror in which you've experienced this kind of heightened perception?
Gee, I think probably for me, I remember, I think probably about 4 years after my wife and I were married, we were living in a little western Maine town called North Windham, and there'd been a snowstorm the night before. And my daughter Naomi was about 3, and my son Joe was about a year and a half old. And they had a snow shovel, and they were shoveling off the porch. And I was putting library books in the car because we were going to go to the library. And I heard my son cry out. And when I turned around, he was lying face down in the snow, and my daughter was standing beside him. They had gotten a hold of the shovel, and each one was trying to pull it away from the other one. And my daughter's grip had slipped, and the shovel had come back and cut him severely with the corner in the face. And when I picked him up out of the snow, he appeared to have no face. It was just blood from the hairline to the chin, with one eye staring out of it. And I was convinced that he was going to die. And if he wasn't going to die, he was probably going to lose one of his eyes. And I remember not knowing what to do. But beyond that, I remember very clearly how the sun made all these little tiny sparkles, millions of sparkles off the snow. And I remember very clearly running with him in my arms into the house to use the telephone, and the way the blood splashed in these droplets like coins on the hardwood floor. These are memories that are very clear in my mind, and their clarity stems directly from the fact that, you know, I was over the moon with terror.
Your son healed well?
He did heal well, yeah. He has a little tiny scar. It severed the optic nerve, but they were able to sew that back together. So he sees, and everything's fine.
Wow. So
not the optic nerve. They couldn't have fixed that. It severed the tear duct.
Huh. Were you already writing when this happened?
Oh, yeah.
Like publishing?
Mm-hmm. I'd published Carrie at that time and Salem's Lot. 2 books. I was 2 books into the job at that point. That's a lot of years ago. Joe is now 20,
you feel,
I think.
After having experienced something like this and experienced the terror of it, how did you feel about going back and writing about this kind of physical terror? Did you feel like now that it had happened to your family, you should kind of back off a little bit?
No, I don't think so. I don't see any correlation between the writing and my daily life in this sense. I don't think that the writing of terrible things serves as some kind of magic hex symbol, like on a barn door. You know, the way that the Amish put the hex signs up, and the idea was to keep the bad luck out of the barn.
Mm-hmm.
They were very religious people. They are very religious people, but that's never stopped them at all from the hex symbols. No more than it stops an atheist, you know, from tossing salt over his shoulder when he spills it. But I never saw the act of writing about terrible things as a way to hedge my bets, a kind of supernatural throwing salt over my shoulder. Nor did I ever think that writing about stories of terror would in some way, you know, cause those things to happen, that it wouldn't do either one. What I can tell you that about this is that I did write a book called Pet Cemetery a few years ago, in which a very small child runs into a road and is run over by a truck and killed. And at that time, when I got ready to write that book, my wife and all three of our kids were living in a little town not too far from where I'm talking to you. And Owen was about the age that Joe was when he got hit by the snow shovel. And at that time, he was just walking or toddling along, and it became great fun to play get away from mother and get away from father. And we were having a picnic, and he got off the blanket and ran straight toward the road, Route 15 up here, which was a very busy road, a lot of trucks going back and forth. And he was running for the road as fast as his little legs could carry him, and I could hear the truck coming. And I ran, and I caught him. And I caught him by one leg, and he went face forward into the gravel on the shoulder of the road. And a few seconds later, the truck went by, a great big one that would have killed us both if we'd gone into the road. And that happens a lot in life. In fact, that's one of the more convincing arguments for the existence of God, is how many times the truck passes us by and how few times it ends up flattening somebody. I mean, obviously the times when somebody gets flattened or, you know, you remember the case where the drunk guy ran into the school bus and 70 people got killed. That made the papers. What doesn't make the papers is all the times that the drunk guy misses the school bus. So when I wrote Pet Cemetery and the truck actually hits the kid, what I was saying to myself is, I want to know what would have happened. I want to explore what life would have been like if my youngest son had been killed instead of, you know, living to be what he is now, which is a big 15-year-old kid who's happy most of the time and getting A's in school and that sort of thing. And I think that it's a really human desire to want to peek through the keyhole into hell.
Stephen King, recorded in 1992. His latest book is the collection of short stories, Nightmares and Dreamscapes. His new TV miniseries, The Stand, is based on his 1979 novel, which was published in an expanded version in 1990. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.